You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Shot Chasers by Catherine Aben. According to the officials, Brian Kavanaugh, a special assistant to the president and senior director for resilience policy at the NSC, told Perna, "You need a piece of paper in writing, so when you get subpoenaed by Congress, you can feel good about yourself." Kavanaugh then pointedly violated protocol by standing up to leave without waiting for the four-star general to do so first. Kavanaugh declined to comment. "It was a dick-measuring contest between the NSC and Perna," said a former White House official. Ultimately, Meadows and Azar, the so-called adults, did weigh in, and the allocations were approved. By the latter part of December, as the contested doses destined for essential employees arrived at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, doctors from the three branches of government met there to sign for them. On December 13th, the New York Times reported that senior White House staff were told they would soon begin getting vaccinated. The news sparked an outcry. Why, critics ask, should an administration that has so flagrantly violated COVID-19 safeguards have access to the vaccine when elderly nursing home residents were dying in droves? Trump reversed himself almost immediately, tweeting that day, "People working in the White House should receive the vaccine somewhat later in the program unless specifically necessary. I have asked that this adjustment be made. I am not scheduled to take the vaccine, but look forward to doing so at the appropriate time. Thank you." That same day, Trump made it clear that he wanted the White House's allotment of vaccinations to go to the career staff, who, it's worth noting, were in fact being endangered by politicians and appointees who insisted on working and carousing without wearing masks or social distancing. In an Oval Office briefing, Trump gave very clear direction to vaccinate career employees and prioritize government continuity, said the former senior administration official. Still, the specifically necessary wording in Trump's tweet gave those angling for vaccinations room to continue maneuvering as the back-channel clamor for them grew. It also left room for some justifiable additions. Trump's director of the National Economic Council, Larry Kudlow, who had suffered a heart attack in 2018 and who publicly played down the pandemic's severity, got a vaccination to protect his health. Kudlow, who is 73, told Vanity Fair that he was super grateful to be vaccinated, adding that he regarded it as a miracle that I didn't get COVID from working at the White House. "There were one or two of us who escaped it," he added. While vaccinations within the judicial branch ran smoothly, the legislative branch was the Wild West, said the former senior administration official. "There were 500-plus people who all think they're in charge and therefore crucial to government operations." To federal employees, the seemingly arbitrary rationing of vaccinations has provided a bitter reminder of their own dispensability. Employees at the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, who had been instrumental in developing vaccines, watched as federal employees working on Operation Warp Speed received their shots. "The scientists aren't getting vaccinated," griped a BARDA employee, "but the note takers are." The perception of inequity and lack of transparency has persisted into the Biden administration. In early February, The State Department notified a wide swath of employees, including many who were healthy, young, and telecommuting, that they were now eligible to get the vaccine, advising them to report to a vaccine walk-in clinic at the State Department headquarters. This left even some State Department employees wondering whether the Biden administration's talk of equity was hollow. I can understand having Moderna and Pfizer for colleagues who are at embassies, said one State Department employee, but we have had the luxury of teleworking, not traveling internationally. According to a spokesperson, the State Department weighs the availability of COVID-19 vaccine doses against the risk posed to our workforce at each post and domestic facility when assessing how many vaccine doses to make available and to whom. As it turned out, Donald and Melania Trump were vaccinated at the White House in January, out of the public eye. After saying the doses should be reserved for career staff, Trump evidently made an exception for himself. Which raises the question, did he actually think his effort to overturn the election would succeed, meaning that he would continue to be essential to national functions? Or was the president, like the rest of us, just trying to survive? Additional reporting for this article by Stan Friedman. Thank you. phantom threads. The artisans behind Chanel's Métier d'Art collection can spend years training to make the perfect stitch, the sleekest boot, the tweediest jacket. Leah Faye Cooper peeks into the atelier with photographs by Thomas van Oudrive. Opening photos, tweed the people. Spools dot the work spaces of the Lesage workshop in Pantin, France. A stretch of signature tweed. Thomas Bricout works a loom. Artisans removed their mask only for photos. Last December, actor Kristen Stewart sat in a castle in France's Loire Valley, the sole guest at Chanel's 2020-21 Métier d'Art show. Had a global pandemic not gripped the world, surely others would have been there too. Anna Wintour, Edward Enninful, perhaps front row regulars, Sofia Coppola, Cara Delevingne, and Lily Rose Depp. Still, the collection by creative director Virginie Viard was presented with grandeur. That is, after all, the Chanel way, a sky-high standard set by Viard's predecessor, the late Karl Lagerfeld. Under his creative direction, his perfectionism, his ability to land at the ever-elusive crux of timelessness and modernity with each collection, a once-flailing Chanel was revived to the tune of billions in revenue and worldwide adoration. But it wasn't just Lagerfeld who made Chanel the pinnacle of luxury fashion. It was the artisans from the House of Lesage, hand-weaving samples of Chanel's fancy tweeds. It was the embroiderers at Atelier Monté, festooning fabrics with sequins and crystals. And it was the shoemakers, leather workers, and goldsmiths who craft accessories on which those with the means don't flinch at spending 4 to 5 figures. For years, Chanel has turned to these specialty houses, almost all established in France, and boasting rich histories of expert craftsmanship to bring its designs to life. The creative partnerships have grown so strong that Chanel began acquiring the atelier in 1985 and finally united them in 1997 as Le Métier d'Art de Chanel. The first show was in 2002. That year, recalls Bruno Pavlovsky, Chanel's president of fashion, I ask Carl, what can you do? What can we do as Chanel to make these ateliers even more known, to recognize their expertise? Carl came up with this amazing idea, saying, sometime in the beginning of December, I should develop a new collection, and the name of the collection will be Métier d'Art. And that was the beginning of the story. The inaugural Métier d'Art show, named Satellite Love, featured 33 looks presented to a small audience of editors and clients at Chanel's Haute Couture Salon in Paris. It was not a big show, but it was a very sophisticated collection, Pavlovsky says. The pieces, which were mostly black, white, and red, included a floor-length beaded gown, a pair of delicate slim-cut lace pants, and satin heels hand-embroidered with floral motifs. In the years since, each Métier d'Art collection has been inspired by a specific location across the globe, with many of the shows being hosted in those places. Shanghai, Dallas, and Hamburg are among cities Chanel's notoriously large-scale productions have descended on. Unlike couture pieces, Métier d'Art looks are produced for Chanel boutiques and are consistently top sellers. It was quite amazing to be able to make 2020-21 Métier d'Art happen with such a level of restrictions, Pavlovsky says, noting exhaustive back and forth between the house, the chateau, and public officials to ensure that all precautions were followed. Critics have argued that fashion shows are no longer necessary. given the global reach technology affords, and some have taken the industry to task for what's seen as an unnecessary expense, especially amid a global pandemic. Even in a pandemic period, I think to dream is something quite important, says Pavlovsky. You can take 10 minutes to see something amazing, which takes you somewhere else, and the idea behind shows is an invitation or an offer to do that. In a letter to the press, Chanel called the location of the 2020-21 Métiers d'Art show, Château de Chenonceau, an obvious choice. Situated in central France, it's also known as Le Château des Dames, or Ladies' Castle, as a nod to the many women who have lived there, among them Diane de Poitiers and Catherine de Medici. The estate's plush gardens, checkered floors, and Gothic meets Renaissance architecture served as inspiration for Viard's 67 looks. De Medici's emblem of two intertwined seas found throughout the chateau was a grace note. From their studios, where strict guidelines are in place to ensure their safety, six artisans across five ateliers share how the collections came to be. Next photos, singular skills. Dressmaker Margot Ambrosio sews a bow for leggings. A rainbow of yarn gives color context to the collection. Cobbler Pierre-Baptiste L'Hospiteau stitches boots in the Massaro workshop in Aubervilliers, France. Lissage. I must say, I'm not a calm person, but with weaving you have to learn to be patient, says Thomas Bricou, an artisan who joined the House of Lissage in 2017. Established in 1924 and acquired by Chanel in 2002, the house creates embroideries and, since 1998, the fancy tweeds that have become synonymous with Chanel. Bricou and his colleagues channeled that patience for the most recent Métiers d'Art collection, sewing tweeds that evoked elements of Château de Chenonceau. One, a complex black and white jacquard, was based on the floor tiles in the castle's grand hall. Another was made with silk, chenille, sequins, and ribbons, in colors similar to those in the famous French tapestry series The Lady and the Unicorn. Creating the textiles involved a combination of working on a classic loom and weaving by hand. The samples are hand-woven, says Bricou, so that can be quite time-consuming, depending on the complexity of the tweed we are working on. Bricou's textiles eventually become jackets, skirts, and dresses, which are then embroidered by other Lissage artisans. Needlework is known to everyone, embroiderer Anne-Claire Lockhart says, but when we work with a Lunéville crochet hook, visitors are always amazed. This technique consists of working on the reverse side of the fabric, in other words, blindly. Among embroideries Lissage executed for the collection is a floral motif on the front of a jacket, consisting of 10,000 gold glass tubes, 5,000 pink porcelain beads, and 6.5 meters of gold viscose and lurex thread. In discussing her craft, Lockhart echoes Bricou's assertion about the length of time one can spend on a single look. Even if the designers work quickly, even if the embroiderers are very fast, making an embroidery from A to Z takes time, she says. Time is at the heart of our profession. Les Ateliers de Vernouille en Halat. Since 1990, the Atelier de Vernouille en Halat, named for the small French town north of Paris where they're located, have been entrusted to produce Chanel's handbags. One of the most iconic fashion pieces of all time, a Chanel bag comes to be through 180 operations, carried out by leather workers who train between 4 and 5 years on the elements of construction. Each step in the creation of a bag is important and requires meticulous work, says Steffi Leguin. It's like putting together the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Le Guin, who has been with the atelier since 2015, created her first Métier d'Art pieces for the 2020-21 collection. "I made two bags in the shape of vanity cases that fasten like pouches," she explains. "One is made in leather, the other in velvet. The latter was embroidered with beads and sequins." Concentration, she says, is paramount, as the slightest deviation in stitching can lead to a bag that falls short of Chanel's standards. To maintain her focus, Le Guin pictured her work as part of the completed collection. "What drove me was imagining the pieces I was making on the catwalk," she says. "That's the very best reward for us." Le Marier, the discovery that a garment or an accessory could transmit a message, an idea, or a personality has always fascinated me, says Margot Ambrosio. "This industry is about so much more than fashion. When you start to dig deeper, it encompasses an infinite richness." The Turin, Italy native leaned into that fascination and, after studying styling and pattern making in Paris, landed at Le Marier. The house, established in 1880, was initially dedicated solely to ornamental feathers. Today, in addition to featherwork, Le Marier produces flowers and various other adornments, including Chanel's signature camellias. For Métier d'Art 2020-21, Ambrosio and her colleagues spent 60 hours constructing a jacket collar with organza ruffle satin, and another 14 making bows in georgette and muslin that embellished a pair of leggings. "We do decorations, so we don't know the finished look," she says, adding that seeing the finished product is a highlight of her job. "We made the bows, but we didn't know that they were for leggings. The leggings were not expected." While Chanel isn't Le Marier's only client, like the other atelier, it works with various labels, the relationship is especially strong, given that it dates back to the 1960s, when Gabrielle Chanel first started working with it. "Chanel knows the Métier d'Art very well," Ambrosio says, "and they trust us." Massereau has been one of France's most revered shoemakers since its inception in 1894, creating made-to-measure footwear for a discerning clientele in Paris. In 1957, Raymond Massereau, whose grandfather founded the house, further cemented its elite status when he made the first pair of Chanel's now-famous two-tone 6-centimeter heels. It was this rich history that drew 21-year-old Pierre-Baptiste L'Hospital to Massereau, though his initial interest wasn't in the high-fashion shoes he makes now. "For a while, I was really into sneaker culture, and my hobby was restoring legendary basketball sneaker designs," he says. "Gradually, I turned to shoes and to the trade of shoemaker-bootmaker." L'Hospital joined Massereau in September 2020, just 3 months before the Métier d'Art show. "As a young craftsman, it was a lot of pressure, but the team spirit helped a lot." This was his first time working with velvet goatskin, which Massereau used to make a pair of the collection's heeled fold-over boots. "All the technical stages of the craft take quite a long time, but the seams are still the most time-consuming," L'Hospital says. "People might be surprised to know that it requires the teamwork of several artisans to transform the raw material into a high-quality finished product, along with serious mental and physical concentration." Next, photos in the details. Leathers reveal a season's palette in the Massereau workshop. Nearby, shoe last dangle on twine loops. Steffi Le Guin quilts a classic Chanel bag at the Atelier de Verneuil en Alat in France. Embroiderer Anne-Claire Lockhart perfects a floral motif. Atelier Monté. The final three looks of the Métier d'Art 2020-21 collection are all marked by shimmering cummerbund sashes, each embroidered with Swarovski crystals to depict the facade of Chateau de Chenonceaux. One of them, which was paired with a black satin ball skirt and white organza blouse, was made over the course of 120 hours, using 1,600 crystals and nearly 700 beads. For many, the task would be painfully tedious. For Yusuf Mankayla, it was a welcome opportunity to use the savoir-faire skills he's been honing for more than 30 years. I started working for Atelier Monte as an extra job in the evenings in 1989 for the special haute couture collection orders, he says. Then, in 1990, I was hired full-time. I was the third embroiderer in the Cornélie workshop. Atelier Monte is widely known for its use of Cornélie machines, which have been used for more than a century to produce chain-stitch embroideries. The beauty of an embroidery depends on the stitch length, stitch height, and thread tension, Mankayla says. These adjustments require a great deal of practical experience with our Cornélie machines. Even through a computer screen, which is the only way to see the collection before it's in boutiques, the detail of the sash is mesmerizing, as if 120 hours couldn't possibly be enough time to make it. the King's Gambit. You know Stacey Abrams as the founder of Fair Fight and a leading light of the Democratic Party. Now, Vanity Fair excerpts Abrams' first political thriller, While Justice Sleeps, a tale of conspiracy, biotech schemes, and an irascible member of the Supreme Court. Opening illustration by Corey Brickley. The final word, Justice Howard Wynn sounds off to his nurse, Jamie Lewis, on a fateful night at the novel's opening. And he sits at his desk. Window behind the desk, a thunderstorm going. You can see the crack of lightning in the window. And among other things, he has on his desk a chessboard. This article is adapted from While Justice Sleeps, published by Doubleday, an imprint of the Knopf Doubleday Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC. Copyright 2021 by Stacey Y. Abrams. His brain died at 11:47 p.m. At 9 o'clock on Sunday night, Supreme Court Justice Howard Wynn shifted testily in his favorite leather chair, the high-backed Chesterfield, purportedly commissioned by Chief Justice William Howard Taft. The wide seat resembled a settee more than a chair, but the latter Howard appreciated the capacious width. Unlike the robust former president, Justice Wynn was built along trimmer lines, a sleek sloop to the fearsome cargo ship of a man who preceded him on the bench. But he enjoyed the chair for its unexpected utility, extra space at his hip for the books he habitually tucked to his side, on the off chance the chosen tome for his nightly read bored him. Howard Wynn did not suffer boredom or mediocrity well. He felt equally dismissive of willful ignorance, his description of the modern press, and smug stupidity, his bon mot for politicians. To his mind, they were a gang of vapid and arrogant thugs all, who greedily snatched their information from one another, like disappearing crumbs, as society spiraled merrily toward hell. With the current crop of pundits, bureaucrats, and hired guns in charge, America was destined to repeat the cycles of intellectual torpor that toppled Rome and Greece and Mali and the Incas, and every empire that stumbled into short-lived, debauched existence. Show men ignoble work and easy sex, and there went civilization. A righteous flood, that's what we need, he muttered into the dimly lit study. Drown the bastards out. Behind him, a chessboard stood in mid-play, the antique wooden pieces beginning to attract particles of dust from disuse. Once he'd played the game with a ferocity that rivaled that of grand masters, a prodigy in his youth. Careful maneuvers and contemplations of endgames had been sufficient until he learned that he could do the same in real life, when his mind became destined for the law. The game in progress was with a man he'd never met, who lived half a world away. But even his new friend had deserted him to this last room of refuge. The door to the study had been shut tight for hours, leaving him alone in his sanctuary. Beyond the study, an early summer storm rattled the windows. White flashed in the distance, and then came the inevitable bark of thunder. Wynn nodded in weary recognition of the tumult. To drown the thunder, he turned on the small television he kept in the room. As a rule, he despised the idiot box, but now he reluctantly acknowledged its utility. Tonight, it would tell him if he'd destroyed his life's mission or saved it. A commercial offered discount car insurance, followed by the opening graphics for a popular evening talk show of comedic and political invective. Wynne watched with hawkish eyes as the host wasted no time before launching his shtick. And earlier today, the epic meltdown at American University by Justice Howard Wynne, or perhaps he should be called Justice Where the Hell Am I? The studio audience roared with laughter as the screen flickered to a shot of Wynne speaking that afternoon at the university's commencement ceremony. He'd done this countless times, offering pithy lies about the promise of the next generation. The clip caught him as he leaned over the podium, clad in his academic regalia, simply another meaningless black robe. A tight shot of his face flashed on screen, mouth sneering. "Science is the greatest trick the devil ever played on man," he pronounced to the undergraduates squirming uncomfortably in their metal chairs. The man he watched on screen lifted his fist in anger. "He let us believe we could control our destiny, but we've only built our demise, breaking the laws of nature to construct a shrine to Satan's handiwork. We must be stopped." The television screen filled to frame a shot of a stone-faced Brandon Stokes, the President of the United States, staring stoically ahead as Justice Wynne raged on. The graduation of the president's youngest daughter had brought him to the festivities, and he'd graciously agreed to share the podium with the jurist, who reveled in swatting down his initiatives and eviscerating the laws signed by his administration. The animus between the men had been the source of great debate at the college, one brought to a head by Zoe Stokes's unexpected early graduation, fulfilled by a recalculation of her study abroad hours. With the invitation to the Supreme Court justice already accepted, the college had no graceful way to rescind his speaking engagement. Wynne stared at the crowd, his face frozen in irascibility. In the next image, clearly realizing her grave error, the college's president warily approached from the side of the podium, extending her hand in the universal gesture of "nice doggy." Her voice was faint, but clearly heard by the cameraman. "Justice Wynne, are you okay?" Wynne spun around and swatted at the proffered hand, his voice dismissive. "Of course I'm not. I'm trying to warn you of the coming apocalypse, and you want me to tell these children that the world awaits them. What waits is death. It will come for the others first, but the devil will have his due." At that point, uncomfortable murmurs spread through the crowd, peppered with chuckles of derision, and Wynne turned back once more. "Laugh if you will, you carrion of society. But mark my words, hell has come to earth, and your parents have elected its offspring." With that, he shoved his hand into his pocket and glared at President Stokes, then marched toward him. Yanking his hand free from his pocket, Justice Wynne stopped in front of Stokes and extended his right hand. The president came awkwardly to his feet and accepted the gesture, and the justice muttered something near his ear. The video played the strained handshake before the justice stalked off stage, trailed by the clearly distraught college president. Not sure what Justice Wynne whispered there, but I think it's safe to say he won't be endorsing the president for re-election, deadpanned the late-night host to raucous applause. They call Justice Wynne the voice of the people, but now everyone is wondering if he's the one hearing voices. He's known for riding the subway in D.C., but this makes me wonder if he'll be living in the tunnel soon. Scary that he's the swing vote on some big decisions the court will make this month. And even scarier that is that he's probably not the worst one. I wonder if they'll give him his own reality show, Crazy Justice. Laughter followed, and Wynne flicked off the television. "Funny man," he muttered to himself, staring again at the storm raging beyond the windows. Thoreau had it right about nature versus man. Nature always wins. As he spoke in the empty room, his voice held no venom, only resignation. Nature, he knew, was a crafty adversary. While a man slept peacefully in his bed, nature rummaged through tissue and cell, down to chromosomes so slight as to be invisible. With a capricious flick, it switched on the time bomb that would explode a man's life, a man's brain, leaving me a mewling, puking shadow of myself for others to feed upon like viscera, he acknowledged morosely. No one replied. Too often, these days, his conversations spun out to meet no response. They'd all left him. One wife dead, another deserted. His only son despised him. The court was no better. A collection of sycophants and despisers plotting against him, pretending to care about him. But he'd discovered the way to do what must be done, and the few to whom he could entrust the task ahead. Wynne struggled from the chair and crossed to a bookshelf. He shifted the books to the carpet. The task was harder than it should have been. With a glance over his shoulder, he checked that the door was still closed. "Don't want that sneaky viper to creep up on me and steal more of my secrets," he muttered. Wynne entered the combination to the safe. The lock popped quietly and flashed its green entry signal. He tugged at the handle. Inside, the contents were exactly as he'd left them. Soon, though, he'd forget what lay inside. Worse, he'd forget that he even had a safe, and the other hiding places he'd set across the whorish town. Places that might betray him by refusing to be found. Such was his fated end, from brilliant jurist to a hollowed-out shell of a man chased by shadows, betrayed by memory. Time had winnowed itself down to nothingness. At some point, his enemies would attempt to rush him toward death. But he knew a secret. Between the end and now lay uncharted territory that he alone had begun to map. His enemies would try to follow him, but they would fail. All except the ones who could follow the breadcrumbs. Each term, the U.S. Supreme Court held its hearings and issued its edicts like gods from Olympus. By law, they commenced their deliberations on the first Monday in October, parceling out times for lawyers and the wretched they represented to beg the indulgence of him and his fellow jurist. But the clock struck midnight at the end of June, shutting the door on deliverance or condemnation. By tradition, they parceled out their weightiest decisions in those final weeks, occasionally eking into July, but never during his tenure. No, June 30th was his D-Day, his Waterloo, his checkmate. He slammed the safe door shut and leaned heavily against the cold metal, his forehead pressed against his lifted arm. What if she couldn't finish it? If they got too lost, like he had? Perhaps if he told the chief what he'd done, what he'd learned, she'd be able to help him. But if she knew, she'd be honor-bound to stop him, deny him this last act of penance. Part of him recognized the argument swirling in his head, a vicious tug of war he scarcely recalled from day to day. The neurologist had warned him that the symptoms would worsen, that the shadows in his once clear mind would grow fangs and horns, that he would see enemies. No, he reminded himself, there were enemies, enemies he had to fight, because if he told the truth, they might not believe him. Worse, they would destroy the truth. Too many doctors whispering about his deteriorating health, about paranoia and anxiety and conspiracy brought on by neurological disease. It was better this way, to wait and see if his opponents accepted his king's gambit, an opening sacrifice to strengthen his game. The White House thought itself so clever. Use his body's own betrayal against him. Send in a spy to watch his moves and figure out what he'd learned. Executive privilege versus the great jurist Howard Wynn? Pah! Filled with adrenaline, Wynn replaced the books, opened the study door, and returned to his chair. His mind was made up. Again, he would play the labyrinthine game the law demanded, and he would win. They wouldn't stop him. Abruptly, the anxiety sharpened, its razor claws slicing through reason in his suddenly clouded thoughts. Wynn jerked upright and hissed into the empty room. "You want to kill me, don't you? Silence me!" He punched the air with an angry, shaking fist. "I know what you've done, how you've lied to us. Soon enough I'll prove it, and even your guard dogs won't be able to save you." "Justice Wynn, who are you talking to?" At the doorway to the study, his nurse appeared and frowned at the outburst. "Are you on the phone?" The clouds receded and he snarled. "I am conversing with nature, woman, smartest companion I am likely to encounter in this house." Unconvinced, his nurse, Jamie Lewis, crossed the threshold. She plastered on a smile. "It's time for your medication and for bed, Justice. You need your rest. You had a long day today, and I don't want you too tuckered to go to work tomorrow. Busy week." Wynn slapped the arm of the Chesterfield chair with a satisfying crack. "I'm not a goddamn child, Nurse Lewis. I don't need to be coaxed into bed like a whelp in diapers. I sit on the bench of the United States Supreme Court." "Yes, you do." Jamie edged closer, her crepe-soled shoes silent on the hardwood. Only her pale yellow skirt made a whisper of sound as she closed the distance between them. With a dulcet smile that she knew would irritate, she cooed, "You're a fine lawyer, Justice Wynn. God knows I've met enough of them, thanks to Thomas." She gave a false laugh. "Perhaps I should have married a doctor, not a salesman." "A doctor? Scoundrels!" This time, the smack of his hand echoed for an instant. "Damned charlatans, refusing to do an honest day's labor, off golfing and finding diseases that were never lost." "Doctors are important, Justice. As important as lawyers, I'd wager. They're keeping you here, aren't they?" "There's no comparison," he barked. "Jurisprudence is one of the last pure métiers of Western creation, like the blues or bidwist. I find modern physicians only slightly more capable than leeches and witches' cauldrons. 8 years of training, and still they only barely practice at their craft." "Don't lawyers practice the law? When we stumble, no one dies." His hand trembled as he flipped defiantly through the musty pages of Faust and knew he had lied. "Doctors are nothing but cranks and convicts roaming the earth, telling lies to the healthy, gathering corpses for their experiments." Bushy eyebrows, twin shocks of alabaster against bronzed skin, lifted and lowered in rage. "But then, that's not much better than this new crop of lawyers roaming the court, a generation laid to waste by the putrescence of their own thoughts. Not an incisive mind among them." Computer-addled miscreants who'd rather be told the answer than investigate can barely find one smart enough to fetch my coffee. "I thought you liked Mr. Brewer and Miss Keene," Jamie reminded him, standing at his elbow. His rant slid into a cough and soon would warble off into mutterings. To urge the sequence along, she poked. "Just yesterday, you told me Miss Keene was a bright young scholar worth watching." "I said no such thing. He levered himself into a fighting stance and spat. "Don't tell me I've said things I didn't say, especially about persons whom you are ill-equipped to hold small talk with, let alone discuss their relative cerebral merit, Nurse Lewis." He sneered her title and clutched her arm, desperately afraid that he had indeed paid the glowing compliment about one of his clerks. Too often, these days, he could not remember his own words from moment to moment, or from afternoon to night. Wynne glanced up to find the nurse watching him, checking him for signs of dementia or the coming of death. Had he finished his sentence? How long had he been silent? "Stop staring at me," he snapped, and tightened his hold on her muscular arm. Jamie obliged and looked away before he could see her worry. His lapses were coming more frequently now. One day, the lapse would freeze in time. She'd seen it once before. Borson's syndrome was the name of the disease, and she could read its track in Justice Wynne's panicked eyes. Gently, she probed, "What were we discussing, Justice?" "Why, so you can report me to the President, or whatever goon sent you to spy on me?" He snorted derisively. "Did I go too far at the graduation? Have they told you to kill me?" The nurse blanched. "Sir?" "Of course you're spying on me," he told her gruffly. "I may be paranoid and dying, but I am not stupid." "You believe I would kill you?" "Nothing so bold and direct. You simply write down your observations and pass them along, in violation of medical privilege, building their case against me." "Sir, I assume they make you report on my impending demise on a regular basis. Probably have you reading my papers at night, snapping photos, so they know what I'm doing. Would love to have you tape me, but their surveillance can't get inside. That interloper in the White House is afraid I'm going to crush his dreams, and they sent you to keep tabs on me. My speech today must have him cursing my name." Her eyes widened. "I don't know what..." "Don't lie to me," he barked. "For God's sake, be the last exemplar of honesty left in this house." A cough rattled through him, and he bowed his head as his lungs struggled for air. "How did they turn you? A bribe or a threat? Did they use your husband?" The flush turned pale, and the nurse's head hung slightly. "Thomas is in trouble again. They're considering arresting him for some scam. He swears he didn't do it," she whispered. "I didn't have a choice." "You had a choice, Nurse Lewis," he corrected tersely. "You simply chose the living over the dead." "They want to know if you can do your job, sir. If you still have the capacity to function. That tantrum at the commencement didn't help." "That was no tantrum, you silly cow. It was strategy. It's all strategy. Opening move of the King's Gambit. Every breath is a movement toward the endgame." His eyes widened and he shook his fist. "Did you tell them about my research? That I know what happened?" Jamie frowned in genuine confusion. "Research? For the court?" "Of course for the court. Why else would they have you here? I am a threat to national security. But one they can't prove without admitting what they've done. So the White House trespasser sends in his carrier pigeons to watch me like a hawk. I know their secret." "Justice, you're not making sense. Please sit down. I won't sit, and I won't be silenced." The bellow carried an edge of hysteria. He thought again about his estranged son. "They can't kill my boy with their lies." "No one is trying to kill Jared," Jamie soothed, her hand stroking his stiffened back. "Please, Justice, calm down." "It's a prisoner's dilemma," he whispered as his voice shook. "My son's life for their defeat. But I've outsmarted them. Lasker Bauer, which they will never suspect." "Lask Bauer? Who is he?" "Not he, you simpleton. In the middle game, both bishops will die to save him. To save the end game." Who are the bishops? Jamie frowned in confusion and gripped his shoulder. Justice Wynn. Who am I? Leave me be. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Colexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.